is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's turn first to the man who covers the State House for the Times of Northwest Indiana, Dan Carton. As always, Dan, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Happy to be here.
We've got a lot of things, certainly with the General Assembly in full stream right now, with all of the stories that are coming out of the State House. So let's catch up on one of the latest ones here that you have posted, not only online, but that's in the print edition of the paper, too. On the latest on this digital Crossroads of America data center that is proposed for the Lakeshore there in Hammond, how's the measure moving along to get some very special tax incentives going for them?
Yeah, so the organization that's putting this digital Crossroads organization that's putting it together has committed to doing at least one building that they're projecting is going to cost about $40 million, be about 105,000 square feet. To put this data center on the lakeshore where the former state line generating plant was, and companies, tech companies, other companies would use this facility as a place to store their data and, maybe transfer it around. But this group wants to get bigger, and they believe there's space there to build an entire data center campus, but they want some tax incentives to be able to do that. So what this legislation that was approved yesterday by the House Ways and Means Committee does is exempt some of what would be purchased, some of the equipment that would be purchased at this facility from the business personal property tax and from the state's sales tax as an incentive for this developer to go ahead and expand this data center well beyond just the one building that they currently have planned.
I know that the representatives from the company, basically we're talking here, I guess, about the CEO from Digital Crossroads, Peter Feldman, as well as some of the other folks, and I suppose even Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. had a chance to chime in on this at the House Ways and Means Committee meeting.
Yeah, they were actually down there last week, and they pointed out that states across the country are competing for these data centers. Indiana is actually kind of behind a lot of other states. Big chunks of Virginia have a lot of these data centers because they have a lot of military companies and government companies, but they also need some in the Midwest. So this is a real opportunity for Indiana to jump into this data center market and give companies a reason to locate them here. And I should point out that this isn't just for the Hammond data center. The legislation kind of sets up tiered incentives for other communities to get in on this, so you wouldn't have to spend as much in a smaller community to see some incentives relative to what this organization is planning to spend in Hammond.
So it seems like this measure in turn is kind of like others that come up before the legislature, and they may talk about improvements of some type to the economy for the entire state. Happens to be the city of Hammond that is kind of leading the way, and if the measure makes it through and it's enacted into law, then the mechanism is there for any community, I guess, in the state to be able to take advantage of it.
Right, and one of the things these companies and Mayor McDermott, a lot of these people have pointed out that while you're giving these incentives to this data center, there's going to be a lot of follow-on business from companies that sell to the data center and companies that employ people who work in relation to this thing. So it's and they won't be exempt from anything. So they'll be paying the tax, and you end up with this economic driver that you wouldn't have but for the tax incentives. That ends up growing a lot of other businesses and property values and things like that that are, at least these legislators think, good for the state.
Now, up next, I guess it'll actually be the full House that gets to take a look at this and make a decision on it before it goes over to the Senate for their consideration. Any word as to when the measure is supposed to come up before the House?
Probably next week. Mm-hmm. So the committee vote was yesterday, which means it could be eligible for amendment in the House as soon as Monday or Tuesday. Could get a final vote maybe by next Thursday. And that would just send it to the Senate. It's definitely not a done deal.
Yeah. And along with not only the city of Hammond working hard to try to get the financial incentives in to help the folks with the data center in Hammond, but also, too, we've got the accompanying bill, I suppose, but it's another bill separately, of course. We're talking about, the plans for economic development in the city of Gary along the lake shore and the airport area there. And tell us about what what Senate Bill 66 actually is creating and how, in turn, is going to help push business along in Gary to be here.
Yeah, so this is actually related to the gaming bill, even though it's separate from that. So the gaming plan envisions taking the two Majestic Star casino boats, moving one of them to a land-based location along 8094, and sending the other one down to Terre Haute. Not the actual boat, but they're going to send the gaming license, because through a historical quirk, that even though the Majestic Star operates as one casino, it's technically two.
Yeah.
Once that happens, the reason Gary is pushing for that to happen is because they have this idea to develop the Buffington Harbor area as an intermodal transit hub, where companies that normally send their products into Chicago, you know, on rail or on trucks or on airplanes, or on boats. That's a very crowded environment in Chicago. It gets backed up. You know, there's a lot of delays, especially with rail, when they have to go through Chicago. So the thinking is, if we can get them to stop in Gary, that would be able to turn Buffington Harbor into a place where these transportation options stop and products would be warehoused there and reshipped from there, and that would create a lot of jobs and economic development in Gary. First, you have to clear out the casino. So the Senate Bill 66 would, instead of having the city run the development project connected to Buffington Harbor, it would create this new sort of state-city hybrid board. They call it the Transmodal Compact, that would be in charge of this, and it would be a lot of sort of economic development experts, transportation experts, different state agency heads. The city would have at least a few, as the measure is currently written, representatives on this board, but it would be sort of the almost like a regional development authority just within Gary.
Yeah. And I guess this new compact board, as they're calling it, not only has members on the board coming from Mayor Freeman Wilson's appointments, but also that actually have its own a separate executive director to kind of run the thing, I suppose. Maybe in a way, the city of Gary is looking something along the same lines as the Port of Indiana at Burns Harbor?
Well, no, they're not. The mayor has made it pretty clear that she doesn't want to necessarily compete with the port, but
yeah,
just to be, you know, another, but make the harbor into an area where you could do some shipping, whether it's, you know, to the Port of Chicago or to Burns Harbor, or just moving things around out there.
Now, how does the measure seem to look now, since it's come up and gotten through some of the committees, and we know there's more committee work, and of course, before it even goes to the Senate floor for a vote, what seems to be the prospect for it right now?
Yeah, it looks pretty good. I was actually at a committee hearing this morning that I ran over from to talk with you guys. So there is some concern from the people of Gary, and the mayor has made pretty clear that she would like to have more say, more control over how this board ultimately works. But everybody, local and state, seems committed to working together to advance this, because if it helps Gary, it'll help the region, it'll help the state, and everybody stands to win from this if it works out the way that everybody hopes it will. So there is a definite commitment to get this done. The bill is sponsored by the Appropriations Committee chairman, so he's got he knows a guy who can help it get through the Appropriations
That's
Committee.
That's right. You got the right people to direct it in the right direction, it sounds
right,
for sure. So, and I know also, too, that in another separate story that you had in the Times, kind of going along in the same topic, too, that Dan, you had talked about, I guess, the fact that the folks from Spectacle Entertainment, who are the people that basically are going to be the new owners of the casino, are having the opportunity. They took the opportunity for a big PR push about what this this proposed casino on land was going to look like.
Yeah, this was so last week they did have the hearing on the gaming bill, which is set for a committee vote next week. And Spectacle, who is buying the Majestic Star, that deal looks to get state regulatory approval in March and probably will close at the end of March, said that if they do succeed in buying it, as it looks like they will, and they are allowed to move off the water, they want to build a $300 million casino and a 200-room hotel along 8094 on the Borman Expressway. They're not saying specifically where yet, but they did point to a study that showed that the exit closest, the exits closest to Illinois would be the most profitable for the casino, the city, and the whole development. So that's what they're looking at, where they're looking to put it. And then, of course, they also want to move that second license to Terre Haute, and both places, you know, it'd be a huge investment in terms of building these casinos. Spectacle projects that they'd grow the workforce at the Majestic Star by half, so there's about 800 employees there now. Just moving to the new location, they're anticipating that they'll have 1,200 employees, and same in Terre Haute there. Where there is no casino now, they're expecting to hire about 400 people.
Mm-hmm. I know that your story does, of course, go into, and you had other stories too that go into more detail about this too, but this measure, since it's kind of an omnibus gaming bill, covers so much territory here, you kind of lose track of it. Besides the casino in Gary and everything, and Terre Haute with the changes that are proposed in the bill, you've got the other issue too about sports wagering in general. How's that going to kind of make the bill too hard to handle?
Yeah. Normally, when there's a gaming bill, it gets loaded up with so many giveaways to each different community to keep them happy and get the votes that it falls under its own weight. This one seems to be holding up. Interestingly, the sports betting, which a lot of us thought would be more controversial, just seems to be almost just attached to this thing and sailing through. It's not sparking the kind of fear or outrage or, you know, some other things that sometimes come with what opponents call gaming expansion. So at this point, it looks to be holding together, but as with anything at the legislature, you know, something can come up down the road and blow the whole bill up, and you know that'll definitely almost assuredly happen at some point in the next few months, and then the trick is to piece it all together before the end of the session.
We're talking with Dan Carton, who's the State House reporter for The Times, on the stories that he's put up there from Indianapolis, in print as well as online. One of the other big stories, too, I know, aside from what we've talked about with gaming and the like from the General Assembly, is the issue of dealing with Lake Michigan's shoreline. We know that the Indiana Supreme Court handed down a ruling here about a year ago.
Dealing with this. Exactly, a year ago today.
Oh, wow. That's right. And now we've got the issue that may even possibly come up as well through the General Assembly to try to, I guess, spell in better terms what should be done as far as recreational sources on the lakeshore is concerned. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, the Indiana Supreme Court definitively ruled that the lakeshore of Lake Michigan is owned by the state and is open to all Hoosiers. This case arose out of a couple in Long Beach who have a lakefront house, and they wanted the court to say that they actually owned the beach in front of their house all the way down to the water's edge, wherever the water is at any given time, and that they could control who walks or does anything on the beach. So the Indiana Supreme Court ruling was very clearly said, nope, that is public land up to what's called the ordinary high water mark, which is kind of tricky to define, but basically the spot where the beach ends and you get more into a land type, you know, soil and plants and things like that. So below that line, that's all public property. The Supreme Court ruling went into a lot of, you know, historical detail, you know, tracing the the legal origin of that, I mean, all the way back to like English common law in the 1500s. So it's on very solid ground. But the Supreme Court didn't want to wade into what they saw as the legislature's duty to describe how that land, that beachfront property, could be used. So what Senator Karen Talion is trying to do is codify the Supreme Court decision in law, not just in common law, and then also basically list everything that people do on beaches to prevent possibly another lawsuit from some of these people. So she's just, you know, putting in the code that beaches, these beaches can be used for everything they've always been used for. So you walk on the beach, you could swim, you can picnic, you can play volleyball, you can throw a frisbee, you know, picnic, sunbathe, sit. So it's she's got this bill that just lists all the things people do on the beach, and she actually made the point that like she can't believe that this is actually necessary, but you know, sometimes you need to have a belt and suspenders. So you have the court ruling saying this is okay, and now we're going to put it in the law and saying that it's okay, and that should presumably resolve this issue, hopefully for all time.
Well, I suppose, yeah, this way, if it does get through the General Assembly, which it probably seems very likely will happen, at least that'll allow the Department of Natural Resources to be able to step in. They'll have some authority, I suppose, to make sure that things follow through as what the intention of the law is, to be sure. So
right, and Senator Talion's bill also allows local police to partner with the DNR to sort of exercise joint authority, so the DNR doesn't have to sit up on the beaches when the local police officers are already there and doing it anyway, just because that's where large crowds of people are all summer long.
Well, finally, Dan, I'd like to get some latest in here on the effort. As we know that lawmakers are trying to help the community of Griffith along here. They've had their problems in trying to find a way to create their own, I guess in a way, their own poor relief system, only because they had to take what seemed to be the extreme measure of wanting to secede from Calumet Township. And they had problems trying to find an adjoining township that would take them on. But now I guess the House Ways and Means Committee had a chance to take a look at this proposal. Tell us what that's all about and how it stands right now.
Sure, yeah. So Griffith voters last year voted to leave Calumet Township, where the town of Griffith currently is, because they objected to the high poor relief spending. The township also includes a large chunk of Gary, and Griffith felt that they weren't getting any spending in their town from the township, given all the money that they were paying relative to the township, you know, revenue overall. So they voted to secede from Calumet Township, but the law that allowed that also required them to join an adjoining township. So yeah, either North or St. John Township, Griffith requested to join both of them, or separately requested to join either of them, I guess.
Right.
And so far, neither of them wants Griffith, even though North Township is actually going to get hit pretty hard once the state tax caps are fully phased in Lake County in 2020. So they would actually probably benefit from having Griffith. But at this point, nobody wants Griffith. There was a one-year clock to join another township. That's an existing law. If Griffith doesn't join another township within 1 year, they're kind of stuck in Calumet Township forever, as the law is written now. What this legislation, House Bill 1177, that's moving through the House, would do would give Griffith 2 years. So they'd have until November 2020 to try and work something out with either North or St. John Townships. And then possibly, if that doesn't work out, they could revert back to Calumet Township. But it would also set this up for another legislative session. So the 2020 legislative session will begin in January 2020. So if it's looking like Griffith isn't going to meet that deadline by September 2020, then lawmakers in 2020 can figure out possibly another way to help them, or, you know, possibly tell them you had your chance and
yeah,
you didn't get it done.
It doesn't look like that, though, that this measure that is now being considered is going to come up for a vote in the House and then go on to the Indiana Senate soon?
Yeah, so it's the Griffith language actually got amended into something else, some other township measure that has nothing to do with Griffith at all, and it's going to be set for a House vote on Monday. So that would send it to the Senate. So it does look pretty good. There was a separate township bill that got voted down on Tuesday mm-hmm. in the House that would have eliminated township boards across the state. So Griffith definitely hitched a ride with the right township bill and didn't get in on the other one that got pretty aggressively voted down.
Yeah, that's good to hear, too. So we'll hopefully have more to talk about this first of next week, to be sure. And we'll leave it at that point now. And we thank you very much, Dan, for joining us to talk about all these big issues that have come up and topics here in Northwest Indiana that the General Assembly has been taking up here in the last couple weeks or so. And we appreciate your help and hope to be back with you again real soon.
Sounds great. Anytime.
Dan Cardins, the State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. On this Regionally Speaking Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in with Bill Dolan from the Times. He covers generally county government stories, and he's been covering a lot of interesting things happening, and not only with county government, but also to a bit of news on the political side with the upcoming primary elections. And Bill, as always, thanks for taking time to join us today on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let's start out first here talking about another addition to the fast, well, it won't be fast growing now. The candidates' races are pretty much set now for the primary election in the city of Gary, but we have another candidate for mayor. Tell us about how Jerome Prince is interested in switching from county government to Gary city government.
Jerome Prince filed for Gary mayor on Friday. I have to check my calendar here.
Yeah,
the February the 8th, that was, of course, the last day of filings. And he joins a cast of 10 who are including Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson. So she has 9 challengers to oppose her in the May 7 Democratic primary. And Jerome Prince is a former Gary City Councilman who became a Lake County Councilman about a decade ago, and then about 5 or 6 years ago became the Lake County Assessor. He's responsible for calculating how much each person's property tax bills will be. He seemed pretty comfortable in that job. He just got reelected last year to county assessor, but he has decided now that he wants to take on the city of Gary, which is a rather large challenge. As anybody, any listener, regular listeners to your show would know, given all of the problems of poverty and blight in the city.
What does he seem to feel as a campaign that he is interested in taking on?
Well, since he filed the last day before he could, we really haven't. He's been reluctant to talk about. He had suggested early in January that he might run,
uh-huh.
but was reluctant to talk about whether he would and why he would run. Of course, now that he is in the office, he is going to have to put together a platform. And there's plenty to talk about, obviously. The city of Gary is having a world of financial problems. Tax collections are very low, about 60%, which is disastrous. it means that you can draw up a budget, but you're only going to get 60 cents on every dollar that you plan to spend. So Gary is having problems that way, and I'm sure Mr. Prince is going to offer us a solution to that. It may involve cutting City Hall expenses. It may involve new development, which has always been the hope of every administration for probably the last 50 years. But Gary obviously has a lot of problems. He'll undoubtedly let us know what his solutions are as we approach that May 7 primary.
Does it seem that Jerome Prince, because he is the county assessor, that he's very knowledgeable about the problems that the entire county faces involving property taxes? And this kind of goes back to an earlier story that you had in the Times as well, too, where you kind of mentioned in very great detail about how the property tax rates are going to be for 2019 all across Lake County. And, of course, that's all going to change, too, in 2020 when the circuit breaker is lifted. Do you think that maybe this will be, because he has this knowledge, is going to kind of give him an in, so to speak?
I'm sure he will put that to good use.
Yeah.
Before he was even a Gary City Councilman, he was a deputy assessor for Calumet Township, of which Gary is the majority of the township. So he is all too familiar with the problems of trying to raise taxes and provide services for a community where about 10,000 abandoned homes are, and not to mention vacant land that has never been developed. And again, they aren't collecting taxes from these derelict properties. So he knows exactly what the problems are, I'm sure. Of course, the solution has escaped prior mayors as well. They've got to get their tax rate down. They're the highest in the state. That's a discouragement to new business. And they have to put together a program to where you can provide land for a large developer to build on residential business, whatever it may be.
One of the stories that you've had here recently, in routine covering of the Lake County Council meetings, is the latest meeting here, and we've seen a little sense of acrimony pop up between two major office holders. In particular, we're talking about the Lake County Sheriff and the newest member of the Lake County Council. Tell us about that you outlined in your story.
Well, the county council met Tuesday for the month of February, and it was somewhat unexpected that the new county councilman, Charlie Brown, a Derry Democrat, voted no on all of the sheriff's proposals to reorganize his civilian department. And after they passed, nonetheless, despite his no vote. But Charlie went on to explain that he voted no because he believes the sheriff has disrespected him. Charlie Brown had asked for what is called the eligibility list of employment,
mm-hmm.
which if you want to hire on as a police officer, you have to take a number of tests, and those test scores determine whether you are eligible to be hired as a police officer. And those test scores are ranked from the highest to the lowest, and of course you have to reach a certain minimum. Those are posted publicly, but the identities of the person who scored that test are not revealed except to the person themselves. And of course, the sheriff has a right to pick from anyone who is minimally eligible, not necessarily the top 10, whatever. And Charlie Brown said that he thinks that the sheriff's hiring practices may not be as fair as they could be, and he wanted to look into it, and he requested that eligibility list, and the sheriff declined to provide it for him. The sheriff and Mr. Brown had a rather acrimonious exchange, as you mentioned, about whether he had to or he didn't. The county council backed Charlie Brown with a resolution saying that the sheriff must deliver it up. The sheriff later, after the meeting, after their meeting, said that he is upset with Mr. Brown because Mr. Brown tried to have him hire a son of former Lake County Surveyor George Van Til as a police officer. That son, Ethan Van Til, has been a police officer in Florida for the last 3 years, but would like to return to Lake County.
Yeah, he sounds like he's very qualified in his own right, though.
There's no doubt, because he also took the test and scored very highly on it.
Yeah.
But the sheriff doesn't have to take the top score if he so chooses. And that is kind of at the nut of the problem between them. And they've had words, and we'll have to see whether whether they make up or there's going to be problems for the years to come.
Well, it sounds like some great stories that may come about and to continue here, even just in such things as routine Lake County Council meetings, to be sure here, because we know that the Sheriff Martinez is going to have to come back in and talk with the council members over time on other issues as well, too. And Bill Dolan, thank you for spending time with us to talk about the stories that you've had out there online as well as in print in the Times, and we hope to have you back on again soon.
Thank you.
Coming up to bat next in the lineup here on Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday today, we have Joe Pete, who is the business reporter for The Times. And as always, Joe, thank you for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Let's take on a couple, to start things out, let's take on a couple steel-related stories, one of them local or relatively local, we're across the state line, yeah, and the other more international here. Tell us about this latest project that North Point Development is proposing and what they in turn might bring for Northwest Indiana.
Yes, it should bring job opportunities that are relatively close commute. North Point Development. It's a suburban Kansas City-based industrial development company. It's one of the largest in the country. It's done close to 49 million square feet, I believe, since 2011 or so. It's responsible for that supplier park next to the Chicago Assembly Plant in Anguish, where you have a lot of the suppliers, the ones that aren't in Northwest Indiana, serving the Ford plant there. And it's going to build a new project right next to that, the North Point. Or it's going to build it at the former Republic Steel Mill, which has a lot of history. It was kind of known as Little Steel, but that's where the infamous Memorial Day massacre in 1937 took place, when 10 striking steel workers were killed, including a few from Northwest Indiana. It was long operated as a Republic plant and then LTV Steel, but like all the other mills on the southeast side of Chicago, it eventually disappeared, closed for good in 2001. The site is kind of sad. You know, vacant since there's a memorial across the street to honor the steelworkers who have been killed. But this company is going to come in. It's going to build a new $164 million industrial campus that it just broke ground on. It's going to hold up to 10 companies, either industrial or logistics. And they're projecting it'll create more than 1,300 new construction and factory jobs. A lot of the Northwest Indiana, you do have a lot of factory workers who commute over to that area, the Ford plant in particular. They're a big employer of region residents. You see them. That's why the UAW like marches during the Highland 4th of July parade. They do, you know, local Habitat for Humanity projects. They sponsored a house, I think, on that they built in 45th and Hammond. I'm 45th in Highland, but they're a big, local employer. This will mean, you know, more, local employment opportunities that people would have an easy time commuting to. This plant that they're talking about is basically right across on the other side of Wolf Lake from Hammond, on the far southeast side of Chicago.
Does this project seem to be, from what you've seen, maybe one of the more, at least the potentially more successful ones than others that have gone up in other spots on the south side of Chicago? We know that there have been plans for very ambitious plans for housing projects and all kinds of things that were supposed to go up on some of the land that is still sitting vacant. Does this one seem to be a bit more successful?
Yes, the one at the former U.S. Steel Southworks site, that has been, it's been called one of the most, prime waterfront parcels in the entire country, but there have been all these, big plans for redeveloping it that would cost billions of dollars, and, you know, there was a sign out for years there that there's going to, Mariano's coming soon, and, they're anticipating all these condos and all this lakefront living, and then there was supposed to be, some manufacturing plant where they manufacture modular housing, I think by some international company, but pretty much everything they pitched for that site has been too, it's such a massive site that you have a lot of people trying to go in there swinging for the fences with these huge ambitious projects, and nothing has really happened so far. You do have that nice steelworkers park there, which is a nice peaceful park with a kind of tribute to the history of steelmaking on the southeast side, and you can go and enjoy the lakefront and the trail among some gardens, and they have information there about Calumet region history and everything. It's neat to see, and that there's that big iron ore break wall where the for the ships that used to come in on the lake, and it's kind of an impressive ruin to go check out, but everything at that site has pretty much been stalled. This is more. They already broke ground on this, so this isn't just some quixotic plan that they're throwing out there and hope that it sticks. This is a reputable developer. They already did that supplier park by the assembly plant, and they are they're breaking ground on this. And you have started to see a lot more new industrial development on the south side over the last several years. In Pullman, they've been putting up new, you have that new, the new lettuce company, and they've had just a new, industrial development going in there. There's a Chinese company that's going to start building train cars for, The MTA or the CTA, there's just been a lot more industrial development in recent years.
Yeah, I got that impression. That's why I even too when the word came out, and I've taken a look at some other reports too have come out of the Chicago industrial area that they talked that the city of Chicago is offering up tax increment financing. So they've obviously made a big commitment, and this one's going to go through where maybe the former U.S. Steel Southworks didn't, at least not right now anyway, to be sure. So
And Whole Foods also moved its distribution center from Munster up to the Pullman area, and then the Jacksonville Jaguars owner, his company Flexengate also recently made a pretty big investment by the Chicago Assembly Plant.
That's good. Now, we mentioned the other item that we mentioned about international steel, of course, deals with Congressman Pete Fiskoski. He made an appearance before the International Trade Commission, and of course, he's once again championing Northwest Indiana Steel. Tell us about that.
Yes, there's been a lot of talk about the Section 232 tariffs of 25% on pretty much all foreign-made steel. It has had a big impact on the steel industry. You saw basically like a 5% increase in shipments last year. Prices have been sagging for a while now, but they're much higher than they were during the downturn. It kind of shored up demand. But what people forget is that there are already 240 tariffs on various steel products. Where the foreign companies have been alleged to have broken U.S. trade laws, to have enjoyed benefits of like huge subsidies that, you know, our steelmakers don't have, or to be dumping steel here at a loss deliberately with the intent of kind of gaining long-term market share. And then, you know, when they put our steel mills out of business, then the prices won't be quite as low. That's, you know, they'll use it as a kind of a predatory business tactic that they're defending against, but they have 240 different tariffs on steel from all over the world. And out of the 400, you know, that's a huge chunk of the 465 total tariffs that the U.S. imposes on various goods. Steel seems to have the most, violations of international trade law that the International Trade Commission and the U.S. Commerce Department are finding. And the latest case they're investigating is whether Chinese companies have been dumping cast iron soil pipe here, which is used for a number of things, stadiums, high-rising, plumbage, ventilation, drainage. It's used in a lot of different development projects throughout the commercial sector. And Vyskovsky went to testify before the Trade Commission to urge for, you know, tariffs of up to 300% to offset the dumping, and then of up to 111% to offset, you know, subsidies these companies have been getting. The Chinese steel industry has caused a lot of disruption in the global steel market. It's heavily subsidized. Back as recently as like 2006, U.S. Steel was exporting steel made in the United States to China, and that was a big growth area for it. But since then, they've really built up one of the largest steel industries the world has ever seen. They're currently making 10 times as much steel as Japan, India, and the United States, which are the next three largest steelmakers globally. They produced a record 928 tons of steel last year. No one has ever come close to that in human history. And the problem is that they're not consuming all that domestically. They're building it. The government is there subsidizing these jobs, these good, high-paying like steelworker jobs there. They're producing more steel than their economy needs, and then they're basically dumping it on the world market at cut-rate prices, which has affected us in the United States, but still, steelmakers all over the world.
Well, it sounds like here,
overcapacity has been a huge ongoing problem for the global steel industry.
Well, it seems like that Congressman Vyskovsky, this is one of the things he has been working on for years and keeping to the forefront. And we know this is his opportunity if he's going before the commission to remind the commission members that this is not just an international issue; it's a local issue, and we're talking not only U.S. but Northwest Indiana issue too, because of all the jobs of the factories as well as the steel companies are involved.
Oh yes, the whole issue is especially with the Section 232 tariffs. Like a lot of the talk is about preserving the steel industry here from these this cheap overseas steel that they're deliberately selling at a loss. And the reason being is under the Section 232 rationale, which some have disputed, it's along the lines of we really need a steel industry. If we ever go to war, we're going to need to be able to make tanks and warships and things of that nature. Like some of the plate they make at ArcelorMittal Burns Harbor, that goes deliberately into like Navy, battleships. And the argument is that it needs to be defended. But the thing is, though, if you have like these newer mills in China, and they're not concerned with whether or not they're turning a profit, and they're shipping, you know, because honestly, if you're shipping steel, it weighs a lot and it's very expensive to ship. It should not be cheaper if you're shipping it like across an ocean to somewhere. The only way they kind of can achieve like the lower prices is through, you know, heavy subsidies or not caring whether they're profitable or not. And the thing is, if they put us out of business, then they'll have us over, you know, our steel mills out of business. Not only will we lose thousands and thousands of really high paying steelworker jobs, they would cause a devastating ripple effect through the economy, because that's a lot of purchasing power they have that you don't have in a lot of like the service sectors and a lot of other professions. And it would take a toll not just on, you know, steelworkers and their families, but also on many local business owners. It would just have the sweeping effect, local banks, all manner of local institutions. And the thing is, beyond just like preserving that, though, there's the issue of that, the steel industry could be needed again in times of war, and that it remains like a pretty big part of the economy nationally and a pillar of the local economy.
Let's shift the focus here now from steel over to the air. Actually, the air show is what we're thinking of here. We know that everybody enjoyed the Gary Air Show for many, many years. Unfortunately, they've had to discontinue the show here for economic reasons. But it seems like that there is a hint of hope, I suppose, that you might get to see some of these big military jets fly through the air in at least in the next couple of years. Tell us the latest that you've heard on that, too, please.
Yes, they were literally saying like the Gary Air Show would potentially come back. You know, it had been canceled again last year. It hasn't been held since 2016. They're originally looking to bring it back this year, hopefully with a sponsor that would be funding it, so the city of Gary would not have to run it at any cost. It had previously been operated by the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority for about 7 years. The city of Gary has taken it over, but they've had financial problems and apparent difficulty lining up sponsors. It is a very expensive event to hold. You're bringing in a lot of like military jets, like the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds, the U.S. Army Golden Knights, the Blue Angels, the ones you see in the Chicago Air Show and a lot of the other big air shows across the country. But the now they're saying it won't kind of come back in its full form until at least 2021. It's because they're not going to be able to get the military jets back until then. They are looking at kind of smaller, what they're calling pre-air show events, where this year in the third week of August, there will be a air show with like some kind of private aviation operators, no military stuff, none of the parachutists or any of the jets roaring overhead or anything, and it will be in a much smaller venue at the Gary Chicago International Airport, and that'll be taking place in the third week of August. But it'll be a far cry from, you know, the previous shows where you had 500,000 to 600,000 people cramming Marquette Beach in Gary over and the adjoining Lakeshore National Park over like a 2-day period. It was like always a weekend long air show. It was a, you know, huge draw to the city. A lot of people came in who would never otherwise visit Gary. And you know, they do recognize the impact, and they are looking to bring it back. But there have been, you know, ongoing financial things, and they're still trying to line up sponsorships because it is not a cheap event to put on.
I know you mentioned that because you had a chance to talk with Spiros Batistatos, the president and CEO with the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority, about this topic, too. I guess when the news first came out that the city of Gary was going to do these pre-air show events beginning this coming August, I suppose that there probably are the units out there, promoters for these types of planes out there, that they'll probably take advantage of the smaller venue, certainly smaller than the regular Gary Air Show, to be able to show off their planes and the pilots and try and make as much entertainment out of it as they can.
Absolutely. Well, next year, it's still technically a pre-air show event versus the full-blown air show, but it will be returning to Marquette Park in 2020, saying now, or they're hoping anyway. But they're promising to bring at that point well-known air show performers. That no one's been confirmed as of this point, but you know, you have all those daredevil pilots and people walking on the wings of, you know, planes and things of that nature. You know, it's kind of the big draw to these things is always like, you know, the Blue Angels or the military stuff, because you know, you have the thunderous, you know, roar overhead, and you can hear it from, you know, miles away, and you know, they're kind of the most impressive. But they're going to bring in some of the more national touring things. Part of the problem was they had fallen out of the rotation because these groups tour, like, there are air shows all over the country. Obviously, we're familiar with the Chicago one that stages at the Gary Chicago International Airport and flies over, you know, North Beach and that area.
Yeah.
But these are, you know, they have these all over the country. There's one down in Indianapolis, and there's a rotation of cities that these touring military jet squadrons visit. And Gary had just fallen, you know, Gary hasn't had it for 2 years now. This is going on a third year, and they've fallen out of the rotation, so they just have to get their place back. And the timing in the future will probably be dictated by when they can find a slot, like when these military squadrons are available.
Let's shift now from the air show to another area that covers the air as well. We're talking about hot air balloons. People, of course, are familiar. If you go down to Indianapolis just before the state fair every year gets underway, there's always a big hot air balloon race there. And I guess we're going to see maybe not something of that sort, but we'll see something of a festival in Valparaiso involving hot air balloons. Tell us how that is all coming about and who all is involved in that.
Oh, absolutely. Connor Prairie and Fisher's, which is that like pioneer kind of museum, like living history museum where everyone acts like it's the 19th century or whatever. They also have a tethered air balloon, hot air balloon. And this is similar to what that will be. The people who have organized the Northwest Indiana Food Truck Festival are now planning the Northwest Indiana Hot Air Balloon Fest at Sunset Hill Farm Country Park or County Park in Valparaiso on August 4th. It's actually a pretty good deal if you have a bucket list item of going on a hot air balloon. Normally, if you're looking to like rent one, it will cost you around like $300 or so. But this is having the tethered ones where, you know, you're not flying around, you know, you're not surveying the countryside, but you do get to go up like 100 feet, and it basically goes up and down, but it's still, you get incredible points of vantage you wouldn't see otherwise. You get the, you know, the thrilling ascent, and you get to just look out over, you know, Valparaiso from a kind of bird's eye view. And, you know, it'll be only $20 to get into this festival and $5 for parking, I believe. And then, it's the food truck festival. You're starting to see more of these balloons being offered. I think they were doing them at some of the Hobart summer festivals, and they were doing them at one of the, like, the Burns Charber Food Truck Fest. And so the organizer of the Northwest Indiana Food Truck Fest had the idea of just doing like a full-blown balloon, you know, festival. There's apparently a big one nationally in Albuquerque that's kind of a big draw to that area. This won't be nearly anywhere near that or size or scale, but it's kind of like a similar concept where people come for the chance to, you know, we have a lot of summer festivals in Northwest Indiana, she was pointing out, you know, but they tend to center around food. It's like Pierogi Festival or, you know, Festival Lakes in Hammond is more kind of music-centric, but you have a lot of, you know, a lot of various festivals, but this is, you know, pretty unique because none of them kind of revolve around, you know, being able to ride up in the air and look around in a balloon like this.
Well, Joe, we have just enough time to cover one last story that you've been able to bring us in print and online in the Times, and it's one of our favorite topics. It's about food, and in particular, food delivery, and people, they use this, I suppose, without even maybe having a second of thought about taking advantage of the apps on their phone to get their items delivered, whatever it may happen to be. And it's certainly getting more and more involved. And the colder the weather, of course, it's just great business for the folks that deliver food.
Yes, there's kind of been with the polar vortex and everything, you definitely saw a lot of delivery orders recently, which was kind of part of the inspiration for this. But like, the delivery apps have really been taking off. Grubhub, they're Chicago-based. They've been operating in the region for some time, but you only had Uber Eats and DoorDash, which are pretty much like the two biggest national companies. They only launched like local delivery service last year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, traditionally you get pizza delivered, you get Chinese delivered. There are only a couple types of businesses or restaurants that are, you know, delivering usually. But the thing is, with these delivery apps, they'll deliver from literally any restaurant, so it's kind of opened it up. And it's beneficial for a lot of restaurants. They do see a lot of increased traffic. Some of them are seeing as much as 10% of their business is coming from these places. It allows, like, there's a restaurant, Foodies in Midtown Cary. They kind of specialize in healthy fare. They said it's helped them kind of reach outside their neighborhood and cater to customers, like, all over Northwest Indiana. It's helped them, like, market, and it's also helped them just reach a wider base than they normally would with delivery, because they're kind of carry-out oriented. But the thing is, though, a lot of these restaurant owners also have serious reservations about some of these services. Some have even been listed on some of the services and had to ask to be taken down or removed because they've had ongoing problems. Like, you know, a lot of these delivery apps will mix up your order. They'll deliver your food late. Restaurant owners have complained that some of the delivery drivers have shown up with, you know, smoking cigarettes and reeking of cigarette smoke, or with kids in the car, and they're just worried about the quality of the food when it arrives there. Because normally, that they've said that, you know, they're the ones who typically get blamed. You might order, like, you know, barbecue from a restaurant, and then when it arrives, like, an hour late because they had to make other deliveries, so they had to fill up gas, and it's cold, people tend to get mad at the restaurant and not at the delivery service, and somehow blame the restaurant for taking its time. And a lot of the restaurant owners said it's really been an ongoing process, because they'll get an order for a sandwich, they'll prepare the sandwich, and then the driver won't show up for another 45 minutes. So they've really had to figure out how to kind of work with these third-party businesses. And a lot of them are taking, like, between 20 and 30%, because they not only charge the customer a fee, but then they charge the restaurant for the ability to use them instead of, like, hiring their own drivers. So their margins are pretty high, and that's another thing that some restaurants have been taking issue with. That's why you've seen some companies like Panera Bread have, like, last year it launched its own delivery service in Northwest Indiana and across a lot of the rest of the country. And a lot of restaurants are saying they're having pretty good experiences with this, but if anything, it makes them want to consider hiring their own delivery drivers and doing this in-house, so they have more control over the quality of the food versus going into a third party. A coffee shop owner kind of likened it, like, if you let a third party kind of handle your food, it's almost like buying a steak out of the trunk of a car. You don't really know where it's been. You don't know how it's been treated. It's not, you know, if it's been at the supermarket, you can be sure it's been, you know, refrigerated and taken care of properly. But, you know, once the third party kind of gets its hands on it, you don't really know, you know, what's going on with that. So you, while this is beneficial and is, you know, it's beneficial for the consumer, it's opened up way more choices than they had previously. It's beneficial for the business owners. They're starting to see more, you know, higher sales volume, particularly higher delivery. They said it's particularly helpful on slow days because people go out to eat on Fridays and Saturdays. People are less likely to go out for dinner on, like, a Monday or a Tuesday, but, you know, they might be busy. They might not feel like cooking. They might decide to just order, you know. But then the other issue, too, is a lot of these restaurant owners are saying their food isn't particularly well suited for delivery. Like, barbecue restaurants say, you know, they slice it and it's meant to be eaten within a few minutes.
Yeah.
It doesn't really hold up to go on, like, a 20-minute car ride. Or they're saying that, you know, their gourmet burger is piled with so many toppings, it's, you know, meant to come out of the kitchen and hot and fresh. And if it's shifting around in a car, it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't look or taste the same when it's, you know, it gets there. And then another concern that they've listed is, like, a lot of these places are very popular in, like, the Loop in these dense urban areas, because they only have to travel a couple minutes usually to an office to deliver your food from the restaurant. But the problem is Northwest Indiana is generally very suburban in character. You know, you have a lot of subdivisions, and they just have to travel. These drivers have to travel a lot farther to bring their food to you. So it's that alone creates some problems with quality and, you know, ensuring the food is still warm and in good condition.
Well, it sounds like, Joe, that here again, it's another case where it's a great idea. Obviously, food delivery apps is still a work in progress, and they'll have to get a little more of the bugs worked out, so to speak, here. Not intending to say food has bugs, but sometimes sometimes the delivery process has bugs in it, too. That's what I'm sure they're working out. Well, Joe, we'll leave it at that.
The companies do say they are working on it.
Yes. That's right. Thanks, Joe. Joe Pita is the business reporter for The Times, and as always, thank you for spending time with us today, too.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Some residents in East Chicago are pushing the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to spend as much money as needed to clean up a contaminated site completely. And reporter Michael Putty was at the meeting the other night, and he has this report.
The West Calumet Housing Project in East Chicago is now gone, but the fight to remove 160,000 cubic yards of lead-contaminated soil is just beginning. Residents living near the Superfund site want the EPA to clean up the site to the highest standard at a cost of more than $40 million. But the EPA wants to pay half that. At a community meeting last night, East Chicago resident James Browder says money shouldn't be an issue.
until someone takes control, we're stuck. Let's put our lives in front of this, in front of money.
It could take several months until the EPA decides on a final course of action. I'm Michael Puente.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday for today. And Regionally Speaking for this week, I thank all of our reporters who have been with us on the program today. And besides Michael Puente, we, of course, had from the Times of Northwest Indiana State House reporter Dan Carton and his colleagues Bill Dolan and Joe Pete. And we'll be back with you on Monday.